It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll hear one expert's policy recommendations for reducing gun violence in Wisconsin.
But first, the topic of birthright citizenship is emerging as an important element of the immigration debate among Republican presidential hopefuls.
Several candidates have come out strongly in favor of repealing the constitutional provision that gives children born on U.S. soil automatic citizenship, regardless of their parents' status here in the country.
Donald Trump has been among the most vocal, but others, including Bobby Jindal, Rick Santorum, and Chris Christie, have also voiced their support of the change.
Wisconsin Governor and presidential candidate Scott Walker has spoken about the issue. He's been accused of being inconsistent on his position over the last week. Most recently, he's gone against frontrunner Donald Trump and says that he supports maintaining the policy as it is.
Joining us to talk about birthright citizenship and its political significance is Alan Gomez. He's an immigration reporter for USA Today based in Miami. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we mean when we use the term birthright citizenship?
That's basically the concept where if you're born in the United States, unless you're the child of a diplomat or something like that who's working here, that generally you get U.S. citizenship just by virtue of your birth. And obviously what we're talking about here is specific to undocumented immigrants and those that come here illegally, give birth here, and then that child, even though the parents are still undocumented, becomes a U.S. citizen by virtue of their birth here.
Are there any exceptions to that?
I mean, very, very few exceptions. I mean, and again, that comes down to whether you're the child of a visiting ambassador or something like that. But it's very, very rare. And for the most part, this country has historically granted birthright citizenship. The 14th Amendment is what's relied on for that. And so, yeah, generally speaking, it's a pretty unanimous thing that goes along with if you're born in this country.
And this is a concept that goes back a long time. What is the connection of birthright citizenship and the end of slavery in the United States?
Well, that was the genesis of the 14th Amendment. Basically, at the time, obviously, slaves were not full citizens. They can vote. All sorts of limitations on their powers in this country. And so, the 14th Amendment was a way to sort of to affect that. And yeah, I'll just read you the wording so we can kind of understand a little bit as to why this has become such a hot button issue right now. And basically, and the 14th Amendment basically says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So for the longest time, that has pretty much been accepted policy. Okay, that means you're born here, you become a citizen. But what we've been starting to see in these last few weeks, actually this has been a debate that's been going on for several years, but it picked up a lot of steam in the last few weeks, is that one part of it that says, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And so what a lot of folks, led by Donald Trump, have been saying of late is that that excludes undocumented immigrants, saying that they're not the jurisdiction of the United States. They're here illegally. They are not Americans, and so they should be disqualified from being able to bestow that privilege down to their children who were born here.
You talked about this issue picking up steam in recent weeks. Can you give us a little snapshot of the political history of this as a political issue?
It's really been amazing. I've been covering immigration for a long time, and every once in a while, birthright citizenship will come up. We've seen some bills, some attempts in Congress to change either the interpretation of the 14th Amendment to say that no, they're no longer citizens if they're the children of undocumented immigrants. In some cases, folks have actually pushed to repeal the 14th Amendment or create another amendment to change that. But that's been very, very few. It's been very rare, and I've never seen it really pick up any significant amount of steam. But then all of a sudden Donald Trump came to town and started talking about this, and it's just absolutely exploded in just these last 2 weeks. And what we saw that was pretty fascinating, you know, on the one hand, you had a lot of these Republican candidates kind of saying that Trump's immigration positions were just too far, that he was going way to the extreme by proposing things like mass deportations of all the nation's undocumented immigrants. But then very quickly, about half of that large GOP field embraced what he said with regards to birthright citizenship. And we're not talking the outliers here. We're talking about Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, Lindsey Graham, Bobby Jindal. I mean, a lot of these candidates have really jumped onto this. Even folks like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, who are considered more moderate on the issue of immigration, they say that they don't want to change the 14th Amendment. They think birthright citizenship should absolutely remain. But both of them, I think, kind of seeing what's been going on and seeing the sort of momentum this has been taken on, have been talking about enforcing the 14th Amendment in a way that they would prevent pregnant people from coming over here if their sole intent was to give birth to a U.S. citizen child. So it really has exploded in just these last couple of weeks. It's been amazing to watch that.
Yeah, it's been an interesting time and an interesting issue. Harry Reid, a Democrat, used to be a proponent of ending birthright citizenship. When did this become a Republican stance?
It's really, I think, been... You know, immigration, for a long time, people have always said that it's not necessarily a Republican or Democratic issue. And there are absolutely specific areas within the immigration debate that cross party lines, to be sure. But what we've seen over the last just couple of presidential elections is this sort of race to see who can kind of crack down on undocumented immigrants the most. Most notably, we saw that in 2012 during that presidential Republican primary, where you had people like Herman Cain talking about electrifying the fence down on the border. You had a lot of these candidates trying to go further and further right to secure that Republican nomination, resulting in Mitt Romney embracing a policy of making life so complicated and so difficult for undocumented immigrants in this country that they would choose to, quote, self-deport. That is, one of the things that helped him sort of lock up the nomination. But one of the other things that it did was ensure that he got only 27% of the Hispanic vote in that election. So after the election, the Republican Party came back and said, look, we need to do better by Hispanics. We need to improve our tone. We need to improve the sort of legislation that we propose so that we don't lose that demographic, which is the fastest growing one in the country. Yet, here we are still, 15 months ahead of this next election, and already it's like a hypercharged race to, again, see who can be the toughest on undocumented immigrants. And so we're seeing things like Trump talking about mass deportations. You had Ben Carson the other day talking about drone strikes along the southwest border to enforce it. And then this birthright citizenship, it's in that environment that this endorsement of ending birthright citizenship has really taken root.
We're talking with Alan Gomez right now, immigration reporter for USA Today, talking about the issue of birthright citizenship as part of the immigration debate. And Alan, we haven't touched on Scott Walker yet. Here in Wisconsin, we're watching him pretty closely and trying to pin down where he is on this. Where is he on this issue as of now?
As of today, he's against changing it. Wait, hold on. That actually wasn't a joke, but he's gone a little bit back and forth. He struggled with this a little bit. On Sunday, he was on ABC's This Week, and he said that the law's there and we need to enforce the law and that should be fine. So he said he does not want to change birthright citizenship. He wants it to remain. He doesn't think that should be an issue, that there are all sorts of other issues within this broader immigration debate that we should be focusing on instead. But that's different from just a few days prior when he was asked if it should be repealed, and he said absolutely. He said it should. Absolutely. Going forward, we need to change this. Before that, he was against changing birthright citizenship. I mean, by my count, he really has gone in three different directions over the past couple of weeks. And so as of Sunday, he was back in the camp of saying that, no, we should not be wasting our time with birthright citizenship. We should be focusing on all these other issues.
Now, the governor said he was misinterpreted when he sounded as though he was in favor of ending birthright citizenship. Do you think there was room there for interpreting something that he said erroneously?
I mean, I can tell you, I've been watching all of these candidates' immigration stances very closely, and from what I remember from that interview and watching it very closely, he was asked if birthright citizenship should be ended, and I mean, what I got in my notes from that interview is, yeah, absolutely, going forward. And so I'm not sure how you misinterpret that. But I think what it does is it shows just sort of how much trouble a lot of these candidates are having with these issues. I mean, I can tell you one thing that Donald Trump has said that is absolutely true is that we would not be talking about immigration to this level of detail so early in this race had it not been for him. He released a very detailed immigration plan that was basically every sort of hardline immigration activist's dream. So it includes all these very specific issues, like birthright citizenship, like deportations, that I think a lot of the other candidates were really hoping to avoid. So it's kind of forced a lot of them to take positions on this so much earlier and without probably the full sort of team meeting to figure out how they're going to approach it. And so you're left with a lot of situations like that where they're being forced to answer these questions when they maybe haven't thought through the immigration plan in such a detailed way as they probably would have hoped to before they had to address this.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That was Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He joined us to talk about birthright citizenship as part of the immigration debate.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the challenges facing Wisconsin kids who don't match up with commonly held ideas about gender.
First, gun violence in Milwaukee has been one of the biggest stories of the year so far. As of this weekend, there have been just over 100 homicides in Milwaukee in 2015. That's up significantly from 2014, which saw 86 homicides during the entire year. That's got many people asking, what can we do about gun violence in the city?
Our next guest says Wisconsin has the power to reduce gun violence, not just in Milwaukee, but across the state. And in a recent opinion piece, she lays out four policy changes the state could make that she says would go a long way in saving lives.
We're joined now by Nina Vinnick. She's the program director for the Gun Violence Prevention Program at the Chicago-based Joyce Foundation. Nina, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, we mentioned at the outset the rise of gun violence, of homicide statistics in Milwaukee. You say in this piece, it's not just Milwaukee, it's not just Wisconsin. What are we seeing nationally this year when it comes to gun violence?
You're exactly right. Homicides are up this year in Milwaukee, and they're up as well in a number of other cities across the country, including Chicago, Baltimore, Houston, and a number of others. It's important to put those numbers, though, in some context and to understand that what's driving the homicide rates in Milwaukee and other cities is really the problem of gun violence. Of those 100-plus homicides in Milwaukee this year, fully 80% of those are the result of gunshot wounds, and that's true in cities all across this country. So putting that in broader context, you know, the United States is really an outlier in the developed world when it comes to our level of gun violence. We have the highest per capita rate of gun ownership among our peers in the developed world. We have much higher rates of gun homicide, suicide, accidents, mass shootings than our peers across the globe. And we have much weaker regulation of firearms than other countries around the world. That means that firearms are much more readily accessible in the United States in cities like Milwaukee and other parts of the country than they are in other parts of the world. And it's that easy accessibility of firearms that's driving our rates of homicide and, in particular, of gun homicide.
Well, let's get into your recommendations on these issues. First off, you're calling for an expansion of background checks to include all gun sales. This is something that's been talked about again and again over the years. You point out in your piece that expanded background checks are often popular, even with gun owners. So why hasn't this idea been catching on?
Well, the idea has been catching on, and that's the good news, because we know that background checks work. And even gun owners know and approve of background checks. You know, since the Brady background check system, the federal system for running background checks on gun purchasers, has been in effect, some 2.4 million gun sales have been stopped to people who are prohibited by law from accessing firearms. So background checks work. The problem is that there are gaps in the system and improvements that we can make to strengthen that existing background check system, and that's what we need to do. First and foremost, we need to make sure that every gun transfer is subject to a background check. The federal Brady checks that are the law all across the country, those only apply to roughly 60% of all gun sales. Those are sales that are made by federally licensed gun dealers. But an estimated 40% of gun transfers in this country are made by private party sellers, not by federally licensed gun dealers. And current law does not subject those private party sales to background checks. Now, a number of states have taken action to extend background checks to apply to those private transfers, and that's something that Wisconsin can and should do to improve its regulation to keep guns away from people who are prohibited. Other states have done that, and Wisconsin absolutely could take the same step.
And are you looking, with this and other recommendations, for states to take leadership on these issues as opposed to waiting for some kind of changes at the federal level?
States are already taking leadership, and that's the good news. You know, there was a push a couple of years ago in Congress to tighten up our gun policies. Unfortunately, that push was not successful. And in the aftermath, a number of states have stepped up and said, you know what, we're not going to wait for the United States Congress to put the steps, to put the measures into place to reduce gun violence. We can do that at the state level. So now fully eight states require background checks on all gun transfers. Oregon is the most recent, passing legislation just this year to expand its background checks. And there's good research to support these kinds of moves at the state level. A recent study that was published just this year by researchers at Johns Hopkins University found that state policies to require licenses for all gun purchasers, all handgun purchasers, with background checks as a component of those licensing procedures, that those laws result in a substantial decrease in gun homicides. So when Connecticut passed a law along those lines a number of years ago, they saw their gun homicide rate decline by fully 40% in the aftermath of enacting that kind of policy. Conversely, the state of Missouri repealed a similar law requiring background checks and licenses for handgun purchasers. And after Missouri's repeal of that law, they saw gun homicides rise in the state of Missouri by 25%. So we know what works. We know that states have the power to do this, and states across the country have stepped up and taken these measures to try to reduce gun violence.
We're talking to Nina Vinnick with the Gun Violence Prevention Program at the Chicago-based Joyce Foundation about a recent piece she wrote suggesting ways Wisconsin can tackle the gun violence problem here in the state. Nina, another recommendation in that piece, submitting records of all prohibited people to the federal FBI database for gun purchaser background checks. What aren't we doing now? What change do you think would help there?
Well, you know, the background check, of course, is only as good as the information that's contained in the system when a gun dealer dials in to check an individual's background. We've come a long way, and we've really improved the submission of records to that federal background check system, but we still have a long way to go. And we particularly have work to do with regard to submission of disqualifying mental health records. Those are records of involuntary hospitalizations or adjudications that disqualify someone from purchasing or possessing firearms based on their mental health history. Wisconsin is doing better. They've submitted more records into the system in recent years, but they still are roughly in the middle of the pack in terms of state record submission. Right now, they're estimated to rank 22nd among all 50 states in their submission of mental health records. The advocacy group Every Town for Gun Safety estimates that the state of Wisconsin has submitted still less than half the total number of disqualifying records that they should submit into that federal system for checking background checks. So the state can do a better job getting those records into the system to make sure that those background checks are effective.
Then you also recommend gun dealers wait until a background check is complete before completing the sale. In Wisconsin, we recently ended a 48-hour waiting period for handgun sales. Why is this an important part of the answer?
You know, most background checks are completed within a matter of minutes. It's a very quick, efficient system most of the time. But in a minority of cases, the background check cannot be completed right away. There's a flag in the purchaser's record. It might be an arrest without notification of a disposition that holds up the background check. The information in the system just isn't quite complete enough to let the processors know whether that sale can proceed. Now, under federal law, when a check cannot be completed within 3 business days, the law allows the seller to go ahead and complete that sale, even if the background check hasn't been cleared. That's what's known as a default proceed. Now, a number of dealers on their own have taken action to say, you know what, as a matter of our policy, we're not going to allow that sale to go forward until we know for sure whether the buyer is eligible to have that gun or whether they're not eligible to have that gun. We're going to wait until that background check is completed. So some sellers do that voluntarily, and some states require that the sale not go forward until that check is absolutely complete. So that's another step that Wisconsin could take. You know, let's make sure we know that the individual is qualified to have that firearm before we allow the dealer to go ahead and make that sale.
Nina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Nina Vinnick. She's program director for the Gun Violence Prevention Program at the Chicago-based Joyce Foundation. She joined us to share her recommendations for changing gun policy in Wisconsin. She shared those recommendations and more in a recent piece in the Journal Sentinel. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Wisconsin kids head back to school over the next couple of weeks. It can be a challenging time of year for any student, but some Wisconsin children face a unique set of challenges because they don't conform to what people expect when it comes to gender roles.
Earlier this summer, we heard about a Frontline documentary on the lives of transgender children. One of the kids the documentary followed was named Arielle, and here she is talking a little about her experience.
It's harder, teasing and bullying-wise, when you're a girly boy, when you're in that in-between stage, than when you fully transitioned. It's much harder to be gender non-conforming than to be transgender, because when you're gender non-conforming, that is when really a lot of difficulties set in.
Our next guests have studied the experiences of transgender and nonconforming children in Wisconsin schools. They released their findings in a report earlier this year. Maurice Gaddis is an assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison. Maurice, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us on the show.
And Sarah McKinnon is an assistant professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So for this report, you talked to transgender and nonconforming students and their parents around the state. Why, Maurice, was it important to get that firsthand perspective?
Yes, we really reached out to the community to find out what perspectives we need to be identifying with regard to transgender and gender nonconforming students. And we talked with various stakeholders throughout the state and realized that there wasn't much information. And getting firsthand accounts from the students from a variety of backgrounds and grades, socioeconomic statuses, races, as well as from their parents and school officials to really find out what some of these rich, unique experiences that were facing transgender and gender nonconforming students in Wisconsin schools. So we thought that having a systematic approach to collecting data from these youth would help us illuminate and understand some important themes and findings of the unique challenges facing gender, nonconforming, and transgender students here throughout the state of Wisconsin.
We'll get into those themes in a few moments, but Sarah, first, when we use the phrases transgender and non-gender conforming, who are we talking about?
Yeah, so, transgender is really... I think it's important to acknowledge that this is a term that's in flux. All terms when we're talking about gender identity are in flux, but this usually refers to individuals whose gender identity and expression doesn't match the assigned sex that they were given at birth. And so there's this dynamic that exists between gender and sex. And so this is an important thing to tease out. Those that are gender nonconforming this can be a lot of things, right? It can be individuals who identify as gender neutral or gender non-binary, meaning that they don't identify with either binary of the kind of normative genders that we use. And so these terms are really used flexibly and in flux. And so in some ways, I think it's really important to not tie down what the words mean.
And as we heard from Arielle in that piece from Frontline, bullying and harassment can be a problem for students in this position. As you looked at this, and both you can talk to this, we'll start with Maurice, how common was that among the students you talked to?
Well, yes, one of the things that did emerge was bullying and harassment. We also know from national data that bullying and harassment is prevalent among transgender and gender nonconforming youth. And more specifically, we also know sometimes some of the bullying that happens around gender nonconformity actually is happening to just heterosexual students who are actually being sort of gender policed and not behaving in ways in which people, society has ascribed gender.
So a boy being not perceived as masculine enough, for example.
Exactly.
That's right.
And so to get more specific into our study, yes, bullying was a part of the study. It was mentioned by many of the participants, and it came from multiple domains. Some people were bullied by youth, other youth at school. Some received some perceived bullying from staff and administration as well. So this was a piece. And another theme that emerged around the bullying was the idea of technology and how technology allowed for people to be accessed 24 hours a day. And it could be, there was a time where people didn't have this kind of access. So you would leave school and now there's Facebook messages. There was a Twitter text. There was a text. There was text bullying. So it was in person at school, but it also happened outside of school in the bedroom, right? If you're on the phone and you get a bullying harassed text message, that's happening in your bedroom. And that could be from people who you've interacted with at school. So we did have a finding around bullying harassment. And like I said, it extended with this technology component.
And beyond that, I've seen statistics in your report, actually, non-gender conforming students, transgender students, more likely to be disciplined and suspended in school. And does that come because, in part, they're being bullied, they're finding themselves in situations that they're reacting to?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really complex situation that's important to parse out. In part, they're being, I think we might theorize this as they're being targeted for discipline because they're identified as someone who's involved in the situation, right? Anytime you're seen as not normative, you're more likely then to be visible. And you're not just visible to your peers, you're also visible to those administrators, you know, security officials in schools. And so that's a dynamic that I think it's important to acknowledge, and then also to think about when developing policies around discipline, developing policies around bullying. One of the things that our study doesn't get into, but that is addressed in other research, is that oftentimes trans and gender nonconforming youth are more likely to be the targets of discipline policies around things like bullying. And so we don't want to doubly penalize trans students when they're also stridently the victims of a lot of these sorts of acts in schools.
We're talking to Sarah McKinnon and Maurice Gaddis from UW-Madison about their report and ongoing research on the experiences of transgender and non-gender conforming children in Wisconsin schools. Let's stay with the staff for a moment. Now, we've painted this as challenges. You highlight some positive stories of what staff members at schools did as well. Sarah, can you talk about what you would point to as maybe model behavior for staff at schools?
Yeah, you know, we really found a lot of the students that we spoke with had one or two school staff that they could speak to about their transition, about their experiences as being trans in school. These were counselors, these were teachers, sometimes these were principals. And when these adults were in the student's life, by and far it made school life better. And so these individuals were really important, and the students talked a lot about that. In terms of the actions and the behaviors that these adults did that made a positive environment, it was things like using the student's preferred name, using the student's preferred gender pronouns, asking, what do you need from me and how can I facilitate that? So just being an advocate by modeling behavior, but then also making sure to ask the right questions.
And you say made the school a happier place. On the sadder side, some of the stories you heard, statements like, I avoid the cafeteria. I would like to not go to school. I miss school because of my fear of school sometime. How big an impact do bullying and the other problems we'll talk about have on the daily school lives of students, Maurice?
Yes, the theme of safety and health and wellness in the school environment did really emerge. And thinking about ways in which some of the youth talked about keeping themselves safe, sometimes that meant avoiding going to school just to not have these negative interactions. Sometimes that meant avoiding certain teachers, certain faculty members. Sometimes that involved perhaps taking weapons for fear of being attacked and for defense. A specific example of, we think about unique challenges in safety and learning environment. Think of an example of a student who was in the middle of taking an exam, and the principal of the school came in during the exam to take them to the office to tell the student, I want to talk to you about transitioning, and I want you to stop transitioning. It is having a negative impact on your performance. Your friends don't like it, right? So this is a unique and specific. We think of something called minority stress theory, which actually are environmental cues that may negatively impact the mental health of youths, particularly transgender and gender nonconforming youth. So this would be an example of a very specific and unique piece whereby the student's learning experience was disrupted to talk about transitioning, which is a unique experience for youth who are transitioning, who are deciding to transition.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, and some of the national data really speaks to this as well. So, for example, trans youth are 20% more likely to be harassed, called names, made fun of, bullied than their cisgender peers. There are 45% have experienced suicide ideation, meaning that they've thought about suicide, and a third have attempted suicide. These are alarming statistics, and so it's really important to think about how do we work to make the lives of trans youth better in our schools.
And I wanted to get into another area of concern, a thing a lot of kids take for granted, maybe look forward to, participating in sports in schools. This is not an easy issue for transgender children. What would you like to see schools do to be ready to answer this question when it comes up?
Well, that's a very good question. This did emerge, and it becomes complex in that school districts throughout the state have different policies, right, involving locker rooms, physical facilities, bathrooms. So it is complex in that each school has sort of, district has autonomy, and there really is no sort of statewide policy on it. Having said that, the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association did come out with a policy position on appropriate locker room and assignment for transgender and gender nonconforming students. So when you ask what would we like to see, there's just, well, from our data that emerged, we saw what was sort of uneven support, and students and parents talked about the fact that they had to make school officials aware that there is a policy. And then once that awareness happened, people began to understand that they had to help navigate what that means. So part of it is the awareness that a WIAA policy exists. And the other piece is helping, making sure that administrators know this exists and providing training and opportunities for effective implementation. And that is something that we are doing this fall. We're beginning to look at policy implementation, not just around sports and locker rooms and facilities, but around how do districts deal with student non-discrimination policies specifically for gender non-conforming and transgender students. But it's that idea of either A, when there's a policy in place, working to implement it effectively, and then B, if you identify policy gaps, having the community discussion around what the policy, how the policy should be implemented, what needs it should address.
Yeah, Gender Spectrum is a national organization that just released a kind of a guide for helping schools to think about how to meet the needs of trans and gender nonconforming youth. And one of the themes in this guide is about athletics. And I think they do a really nice job of working through some of the questions and the programs and the ideas that schools may need to think about. So I really recommend that as a resource.
We're talking to Sarah McKinnon and Maurice Gaddis from the UW-Madison. They're co-authors of the report, School Experiences of Transgender and Gender Nonconforming Students in Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Was this your experience in school or maybe your child's experience? What challenges did you see and how did you respond? If you work in the schools, how do these issues play out in your district? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with UW-Madison professors Maurice Gaddis and Sarah McKinnon. They're the co-authors of a report about transgender and gender nonconforming students in Wisconsin schools.
You can join the conversation about the challenges facing kids who don't conform to what people see as common gender roles. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Is this a concern right now in your family as you get ready for back-to-school season? Have you experienced these issues as a student a parent, a teacher, an administrator. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Another one of your recommendations in the report, Sarah, is for more support organizations in schools. Why do those make a difference?
Yeah, the students really spoke a lot about what, how, just how much of a difference it made when there was an organization like a GSA, which is a Gay Straight Alliance, in their school, or when there were LGBT affirmative school programs. And so these are things that the students actually identified as making their lives better. And so we found that to be, you know, a likely recommendation for us to take up in listening to the students.
And you looked at schools around the state. How common are those organizations?
It's a good question. We know that most of the students in our study actually had GSAs and mentioned organizations like GSAs. And GSAFE here in Madison, Madison-based, is a statewide organization. And they keep data on the number of GSAs statewide. I believe there are approximately 162. There's somewhere around there. In addition to organizations like GSAFE and having Gay Straight Alliances, we also saw the importance of social support in the school, be it a teacher, friends, parents. So the idea of acceptance and social support in both formal settings like GSAs and GSAFEs, some people call them gender sexuality alliances and organizations of the like, also informal social support does provide, the students said, provide sort of meaningful, positive experiences for them.
Go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to briefly discuss my personal experience in high school. Growing up, I had initially come out as gay because that's what I believed I was, and realized I was more transgendered. Now I understand that I am transgendered. And in high school, very often I would dress in girls' clothes because that's what I felt more comfortable wearing, as opposed to the standard boys' clothes and things of that nature. And I would do that regularly. And the faculty didn't know how to handle that very well, and generally would consider me a distraction to the classroom or a distraction in the hallways, and therefore I would be reprimanded because of the clothes I chose to wear. Where I may be wearing the exact same clothes other girls in the school would be, or in the same classroom, where they actually may be wearing something more distracting or sexually provocative, where I was just simply wearing girls' shorts or girls' tops, and then I would be asked to go to the principal's office.
And Kevin, can I ask how long ago was this that you were in high school?
This was in the late 90s.
Okay. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I wonder, that's, 15, 20 years ago. Would this still be the same story today?
Yeah, I think Kevin's experience is an important one to identify. And this connects with what I was talking about earlier about how trans youth are oftentimes identified as the troublemakers, identified as the problems for being trans or for being for straying from the norm. And so that's why consideration about discipline policies and programs are so important to really think through the nuances of, and to ask ourselves, like, who's going to be targeted by this discipline program or policy?
Also, in addition to what Sarah mentioned, which is very important, the idea of schools with dress codes. Dress codes are often gendered and throughout districts, and of course each district is different, but it's not uncommon to have gendered dress codes, and they are gender binary, male and female. And we know that gender exists on a continuum. And so what Kevin, the caller, was referring to also has this idea of the idea that men, according to a dress code, have to wear certain clothing, and then women are going to have to wear certain clothing as well. And so that did emerge as a theme in our study, youth talking about this, the distraction, the dress code that is gendered. And also that does move to national, right? We see national headlines. There was a female student who wanted to wear a tuxedo, who was banned from the prom, not allowed to wear a tuxedo, right? And a tuxedo is appropriate clothing to wear. So yes, in addition to the targeting with the discipline, and this is why the report recommends different disciplinary procedures, thinking about restorative justice, but also the dress code piece that is gendered and gender binary, and thinking through what this looks like and who is targeted perhaps unfairly with these kinds of dress codes.
Now, at a couple points over the last year in the national press, we've seen the case being made that we are in a transgender moment in the United States. We're seeing a sudden, substantial change in attitudes towards transgender adults and maybe kids. Do you see that in talking to the kids themselves, to parents, to staff at schools? Are you seeing a change going on right now?
I think we are seeing a change. And for me, it's really exciting to see gender being deconstructed and then re-embodied and rethought in these really interesting ways. All of our lives, most of us have been told gender is two things, right? Male or man, woman. And so to rethink gender as a continuum and as a way of expressing ourselves, I think is really exciting. And so I believe that we're going to continue to see multiple manifestations, probably things that are unimaginable to us right now, as we think about this transgender movement and moment.
And Maurice, do you see this translating into policy at the school level, maybe at the state level?
I do see that it has potential to influence policy at the school and state level. Here in Wisconsin, we have seen over the past 3 years, more schools adopting non-discrimination policies in their pupil procedures that do include gender identity and gender expression. Currently at the state level, the non-discrimination policy only protects sexual orientation, so gay, lesbian, and bisexual students. It does not protect gender identity, so gender non-conforming and transgender students. But we have seen, like I said, particularly at the local level, we've seen these changes and school districts actually having these conversations. Like I said, our upcoming studies this fall will begin to look at these policy implementations and procedures and how this is happening.
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sarah, thanks to you as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've been talking to UW-Madison professors Maurice Gaddis and Sarah McKinnon. They're co-authors of the report and working on a book. I hope I can leak that. The report was School Experiences of Transgender and Gender Nonconforming Students in Wisconsin.